October 6, 2006. You're listening to the Infidel Guy Show. Thanks for checking us out wherever you might be on the web. I know a lot of people link to the program, but make sure you stop at a homepage at infidelguy.com. And by the way, if you're in the Atlanta area and you want to come in and sit in with, as a co-host, you know, let me know. We want to have you bring you down here. Also, I'll also have you on the air by phone, provided we don't have a scheduled guest. I don't want to block the guest, the call-in line as well. So that opportunity is available if you want to call in. Introduction song, of course, is once again by Waffles. It's entitled Hydrazine. I'm glad you can make it. By the way, I am joining you in the StickCam video room, and I'm also in the IRC chat room right now. If you have any questions or comments, make sure you type them in red. All right, now I'll try to, you know, again, I can't get them all. I'm really busy back and forth between both rooms, and I'm trying to listen to the guests. So give me some slack. Hey, if I don't see your question, feel free to call in toll free, 888-503-0802. Again, it's 888-503-0802. It's also on the front page of the website. Just glad to be get back. As many as you know, I didn't have a program Wednesday. We just didn't have anybody scheduled, and I needed the break anyway. I've been doing a lot of research, actually, lately. Some genealogical research. Many of you probably don't know, but I have a brother who died about, I guess it's been about 14 years ago now, and one of his dreams before he died was to actually trace our family lineage. So I've been very busy with that project, so some of you might be wondering, hey, where did he go? I've been really busy with that, so... But it's leveled off a little bit now, so I can now get involved more with the program. So again, so thank you for understanding. I really appreciate those who are still gold members and hanging in there with me for another year. I really appreciate that. So your subscription will keep me doing this, I tell you, because it's not easy, believe it or not. But anyway, enough about me. Tonight's program, we have a very interesting guest on the program tonight. And in fact, I saw a debate that he's been in and with Jeff Lauder. And his name is Dr. Phil Fernandez, and he's president of the Institute of Biblical Defense and the author of The God Who Sits Enthroned. He's appearing on the program tonight to argue that Christianity is true, and also much more. He's going to talk about how evolutionary biology is also false. Now, Fernandez has been in several debates with highly respected atheists, as I mentioned before, Jeff Lauder. Also, Dr. Michael Martin, which many of you may know, he's been on the program as well. So, make sure you don't go away. Pay attention to this program. It should be exciting. Welcome to the program, Phil Fernandez.
Thank you, Reggie. It's great to be here.
I'm glad you're with us. Christianity is true. I guess first, let's get some background. I like getting background information. Can you talk to us about your journey to Christianity and why you think it's true, if you want to? Just take your pick.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Well, I grew up in New Jersey, and in Essex County, New Jersey. I was born in Newark. I went to high school in Newark, and I was raised in a good Roman Catholic home. But I was never really convinced of the faith of my parents. My father had a good strong right hand. He was a strong guy, so I went to Mass on Sundays until I went into the United States Marine Corps. But my senior year in high school, I would still go to Mass, but I really wasn't sure if I believed. And I had an atheist creative writing teacher who kind of influenced me a lot, and so I began to question God's existence from about age 18 till about age 21.
Mm-hmm.
And then while in the Marine Corps, life was so different in the Marine Corps than it was back in New Jersey. They eventually brought me out to the West Coast, Washington State, and everything was a lot slower, and I had more time to think,
right.
and I started searching for answers, looking for meaning in life, and eventually, through a series of events, I was led to Christ, and so I accepted Jesus as my Savior in 1981, at the age of 21, and I remember all the unanswered questions I had when I was kind of seeking and rather skeptical,
right,
about God's existence. And so I began to try to study and to answer those objections as best I could.
Okay. So what was it then about the Christian belief? Well, I guess first let's back up. When you mentioned earlier, you talked about there was, you began to question things and look for answers. I mean, were you always a man, trying to find this other element of supernatural, supernaturalism, God? Were you always trying to find God, do you think?
No. In New Jersey, I was pretty content. I was pretty content kind of being my own God and trying to build my own little group of thugs who would do my work for me. I'm half Italian, half Portuguese, but I grew up mainly with the Italians back in Jersey. And so my outlook on life was like, I'm Joe Cool and I got it all together, and I was perfectly content with that. But after high school, I was a boxer and I wasn't doing too well with boxing and didn't get any breaks there.
Oh, wow.
Wasn't making any money, so I decided maybe the Marine Corps could be my ticket out. And the Marine Corps they do a good job. If you got a big ego, they'll bust your bubble, and they busted mine, and I started looking for answers around that time.
Okay. Off topic, kind of, but you mentioned you're a former boxer. I'm curious, what do you think about people who thank God in sports for, like, what do you think about people like that?
I actually think sports, but of course, I'm a Christian, so my response would probably be different than others, but I actually think sports are closer to reality, closer to the real world than Hollywood, for instance. Because if you drop enough passes in the NFL, you lose millions of dollars, you get cut,
and
you're through. So there's a lot riding on it. There's no, you can't drop a pass in the end zone and say, okay, let's do another take. It's just it. You just blow it. And so I think these guys, they get big egos being real talented players, but as they move up from high school to college and then to the NFL and Major League Baseball, it gets so competitive where they realize, okay, I was one of the best guys in my state, but now I'm just another guy, and I've really got to excel, and there's so much pressure on them that I really think that it's not surprising at all that guys would thank the Lord and look for strength in something beyond themselves.
Indeed.
Because, when you're 6'6" and you weigh 340 and everybody else you're trying to beat up is just as big, you need something more than your size. And so, but I actually think that the NFL is like the real life. There is there's chance to win and there's chance to lose, and you face failure, you face loss, and so I think it's actually a slap across the face into reality. And because of that, I think some of these great talented athletes realize that they're not able to do all that they can do on their own, and they need some extra strength.
Right. I guess my question really is, we know why they do it, of course, Phil, but do you think that, and it might even be valid in their minds, of course, thinking that they need to turn towards the extra source, but do you really think God would, like, say there are two Christians battling it out in UFC, Ultimate Fighting Championship, do you really think God would really give another fighter more strength to win a fight? Wouldn't that be cheating? What do you think?
No, I think the way it is, the way I look at it, it was when I was in the Marine Corps, right after I accepted the Lord, I was shooting on the rifle range, and, if you don't qualify on the rifle range, you're not going to be a Marine too long. A Marine there's no such thing as a Marine who can't shoot, okay? So your whole career is on the line when you're in the Marine Corps and you go to the rifle range. You're thinking, what if my eyesight has gone bad? What if I have a bad day? And so everybody's pretty nervous, and one of my officers came by and he saw me praying, and he also was a Christian, but he thought that we shouldn't pray. He told me that we shouldn't pray about something that's unimportant about that. And I told him if it's even a little bit important to God's people, it's very important to God. God's in the details.
That's
interesting. In our life. Now, just praying for something doesn't guarantee we're going to get it.
Right.
According to the scriptures, God answers our prayers according to His will.
So we
might think we need something, and God might say, "No, I could work so much more good out of the situation if you experience loss and not victory."
Interesting. Okay. So God helps people lose as well, you think? I've often wondered.
I, I, I wouldn't say helps people lose, but I mean he can allow people to lose or he can help them. But the scriptures teach very clearly that we are to pray without ceasing.
What does that mean, by the way? I never understood what that meant exactly.
It would mean that. I remember as a Roman Catholic, I used to make the sign of the cross. It was like dialing up God, and that meant that before that point, I wasn't on the line with God. And so I think praying without ceasing. I think the ancient Jews, you go in the Old Testament, and they would start. King David in the Psalms would start each morning in prayer. He'd pray in the afternoon, and then he would pray at night. And that set the stage, and in between time you go about your work, whatever it is that you do, but God is on your mind, and you continue to talk to him. And with me, I was so frustrated when I came to Christ, and now I've experienced so much joy since I've been saved, even
right, we'll talk about
in the midst
that
of the difficulties, that
yeah.
I can't help but, sing praise songs under my breath, which is probably a good thing. I'm not the greatest singer in the world. But that's an example of just kind of praying without ceasing.
Oh, okay. See, I didn't know it was just talking and communication. When I was a believer, I used to think, oh, my gosh, I have to pray to this guy all day long. How can I get any work done?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, let's go back. Let's talk about your journey. You mentioned how you got to Christianity somewhat, but let's talk about, I guess, the details now. What is it about Christianity that helped you accept Christianity and why you still remain a Christian today?
Yeah, I think originally I was just looking for answers.
Mm-hmm.
And I was perfectly content being a wannabe thug in New Jersey things were just so slow in the Marine Corps. My recruiter taught me so much, showed me so much about playing war games. And then they sent me to guard nuclear weapons, which is the most boring duty on earth. You're not likely to get attacked by terrorists or anything.
I've heard.
A bunch of Marines guarding nukes. So it's incredibly boring duty. I really thought I was going to freak out or something. It was just, everything was so much slower on the West Coast than it is in New Jersey. And then I was looking for answers, and I went back to drinking and getting in fights, and of course that gets kind of old.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually I thought, well, maybe I ought to just try to go back to Catholic Mass. And I went to a Mass, and the lady invited me and the other Marines to her house for dinner, and we went there, and they explained the gospel message, and the rest is history. She knew that she knew she didn't have an open door with me, so she had a friend who was an ex-convict who had done 8 years of hard time. She saw the kind of guys that I hung out with. I hung out with all the guys from New York and New Jersey, mostly Italian guys. And she saw that we were, not the kind of guys that she could get through to. So
right.
She just, cooked us a nice meal and invited a friend over who was a former convict who had come to Christ. And he shared the gospel message with me. And
it sounded like he had a tough crowd, I tell you.
I was a wannabe tough guy, but I don't think I ever really,
Yeah. You got the voice for it. You got the voice for it.
Now I'm a grandfather of three, so I hope the listeners know I'm not looking
right.
for any fights or anything like that. My fighting days are long gone. So.
Okay. Again, I guess we get more into. There's so much to talk about. Obviously, we can't get into it in just an hour. Heck, probably not even five. But I guess I'll throw some questions at you, and you can feed off
sure.
of them. Now, I've been curious about this. Let me back up here. What type of Christian are you, I should say? Before making assumptions, I need to know exactly, what do you believe? You mentioned Catholicism earlier. Are you still a Catholic today, or?
No, I'm a lot closer to, after I got saved, it took me about 2 years of studying the Word, studying the Bible to come to the conclusion that I needed to leave the Catholic Church and get rebaptized. And I pastor a non-denominational church, but our doctrine is very close to the Baptist. I'm a graduate. I don't agree with a lot of what Jerry Falwell says, especially on some of his political stuff. But but I'm a graduate of Liberty University. I got my master's degree over there, and so my doctrine is pretty close to the Baptist.
Oh, okay.
So you're not
a Calvinist or anything. You don't believe in
destination? No, I'm not a Calvinist. Yet there's a lot of Arminians I wouldn't want to associate with, somewhere in between the two. But I do believe that humans have genuine free will.
Okay. Well, I guess this kind of goes right into my question then, because I'm curious about, now, in in your belief, do you think that it is the case that God wants all human beings on the face of the planet to find him, or just some?
I believe, yeah, and that's one of the reasons why I'm, in fact, one of the main reasons why I'm not a Calvinist.
Right.
And I have good Christian friends who are, but I believe God wants all human beings to find him. And but it's not like all human beings are looking for him.
Mm-hmm.
The scriptures teach that God is drawing all human beings to himself, but we have the free will to say no and to go our own way.
Interesting. You aren't of the camp that you believe that we all believe that there are no atheists, are you?
According to Romans 1, God has proven the reality of his existence to us through his creation, through the work of his hands.
Right.
Visible God has proven himself through the visible work of his hands, but that mankind suppresses that truth. And so I believe that deep down inside, everybody knows that there's a God, but the easiest person to lie to is ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like every time I sin, every time I do something that's wrong, it comes with a built-in excuse that is so easy for me to accept. The difficult thing is getting others to accept my self-deception. So I think the easiest person to deceive often is ourselves, and I think that's why we often need to double-check and stuff. Now, that's obviously something. We're talking subjective issues, but to test truth claims, we have to deal with objective evidence, and that's what, you know, interviews like this are all about.
Right. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. Now, what's interesting is that, it's funny, just tonight I was reading up something about, well, of course, you know, Psalms 14, I can't remember the actual point. Anyway, the part where it says, "A fool says in his heart, there is no God."
Mm-hmm.
Now, you would think that the Bible is actually acknowledging that there really are non-believers in the world. I mean, deep down in their heart, but they're just fools. How would you respond?
Well, in that passage, I know a lot of Christians quote it to try to, you know, nail atheists or whatever. But I'm not even sure that passage really is applying to atheists. It was hard to find atheists in ancient times, and when you read the whole passage, it sounds more like
particular
guy is acting like, for all practical purposes, there is no God. I'm not accountable to anybody. I can do my own thing. And so it sounds more like what's being addressed there is someone who, you know, a person who wants their own autonomy. They want to govern themselves, and they don't want to submit to God.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily like a modern-day atheist or agnostic.
Right.
So I think too often Christians read that into the text.
Okay. So I'm curious, what do you think the atheist has to gain, for instance, by expressing that they don't believe, even though deep down inside they really do? What are we gaining by doing that?
Well, I'm not a big fan of Freud, but forgive me for using Freudian terminology, but, you know, Freud accused Christians of inventing the father image through wish fulfillment. Paul Witz is a Roman Catholic who's trained in Freudian psychology. I can't remember if he teaches at NYU or Columbia. He's one of the professors there, but he actually.
And I wouldn't say that that's true. I would say it's probably reinforced by that in some way, but I wouldn't say that's the truth. But
yeah, well, and he actually does a reversal. He uses Freudian psychology on Freud, and argues that many first generation atheists may be guilty of wanting to kill or stamp out the father image, and what he's getting at is that Christians can't be put into one stereotypical group.
So whatever
the case, what I'm saying is that either way, I don't even know if I agree with Witz, but either way, there's, you know, something to gain, you know, by hoping there's a God, but there's also something to gain by saying, wait, there's no authority over me, I'm my own boss.
But I
think that's the essence of free will, is the choice between human autonomy, being our own kings, or answering our thirst for God.
See, and that's quite interesting, too, because, you know, I didn't really see it that way. And maybe it's my environment, unfortunately. I mean, I was in high school, I used to sing in the choir, and I was a gospel/R&B artist, and I would see such hypocrisy. You know, people would just say, well, I just pray about it. If they would preemptively pray, I mean, they knew they were about to do wrong things, they just pray about it. I didn't, you know, and later as you know, as I began to evolve and as I began to come to the conclusion that I don't think there is a God, mm-hmm. I started seeing this, really, for what it was, and I don't have those excuses. I can't.
Yeah.
I have to answer to the very people that I'm hurting, and and stuff like that. It's kind of odd to hear you say that we have nobody to answer to. And reality reminds us over and over again, if we're paying attention, mm-hmm. that we do have to answer to other people and stuff like that.
In the context of the ultimate father image, is there this God who is going to judge me? By the choices I made and my actions of this life,
right?
Or is there not? I mean, that's a big issue. But I do think you made a really good point about hypocrisy. C.S. Lewis said that he thought the best argument
for atheism.
Christianity is Christians, but the best argument against Christianity
is Christians. Yeah.
And so what he says is it depends on what Christians you're looking at, and unfortunately, I think if you want to see some loving Christians, go to third world countries. But here in America, we're myself included, are a little bit too spoiled to sometimes depend upon the Lord to the degree that we need to really manifest
mm-hmm.
His reality in our lives.
Okay. Now, why do you think that we necessarily need this higher, rock, this objective rock looking down on us, dictating morality for human beings? Why don't you think human beings can do it by themselves?
Well, I think that everybody makes moral value decisions, moral value choices, and I believe that torturing innocent babies—that's an example J.P. Moreland gives.
Mm-hmm.
Torturing innocent babies is wrong for all people at all times in all places. I mean, there would be some people who object.
Of course,
but I would say no, they're wrong.
That wasn't always the case, I'm sure.
Yeah, I can't see how we get real, objective, universal moral values and universal truths, from a mound of dirt or primordial soup.
Well, technically, if you believe that in these stories, we are made from dirt too, right?
What's that?
I said, well, if you believe in a biblical story, we're made from dirt too, right?
I'm just joking. There's a difference between evolving from dirt by chance through natural laws and just billions of years or whatever you want, and having intelligent intervention with the ability to bring life from non-life. There's a vast difference between the two. Just as there's a vast difference between the universe popping into existence totally out of nothing, totally without a cause, and the universe being created out of nothing by an all-powerful God. I see a vast difference between those two.
Okay. Yeah. You said a mouthful here. What evidences then are there that allow you to make this statement that we have? How can I word this? That we are. I'm trying to say important, but I'm trying to say that's not exactly what I'm looking for. But I'm basically trying to say, what is it about? Yeah, the universe that makes you think that it was designed. That's it. Mm-hmm.
I think scientists are onto something with the anthropic principle, where they take dozens of different factors concerning our own solar system and then concerning the entire universe, where if those factors were just monkeyed with just a little bit, there would be no life on the planet Earth. And they call it the anthropic principle because they say, well, it appears like the universe was designed to support life on the planet Earth. But then these scientists say, but of course that can't be the case, and so they speculate and they come up with different versions of the anthropic principle. I think with science we deal with the world of appearances, and if it appears like the universe was designed for the purpose of supporting human life on the planet Earth, we ought to at least entertain that possibility.
Well, I'm sure you heard some responses to this. I mean, well, obviously, but the universe just wasn't just right for life, say, 5 billion years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But since we're here and we have the brains to be able to, and we have consciousness and we can reflect, we can say, hey, this must be just for us. But who knows, 1,000 years from now, we might just be wiped out. Just like that, and we can no longer say that it's designed just for us. So isn't that kind of odd? Is that what we would call begging the question?
I would think I would think that the response you gave, I would consider that more begging the question. I mean, we're both acknowledging consciousness.
Right.
We're both acknowledging human intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
We're right now miles apart, but we're exchanging ideas, non-material
right.
ideas, and you know, I don't see how we can adequately explain the existence of universal truths or meaning in life, the origin of the universe, design in the universe, human rights, human responsibilities, all these things through just, you know, natural laws, time, and chance alone. Without God, I don't see any adequate explanation.
Okay, let's talk about how God answers maybe some of those questions.
Okay.
Okay, you said, first let's talk about this order and design.
Mm-hmm.
You said that you don't think that a naturalistic view of the universe provided this random, all these random events cannot create what the order that we see today.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Why do we need necessarily to invoke a God for that? I mean, why is that the case? Why couldn't it have happened in a determined fashion, but a natural determined fashion?
Well, I think I kind of question the. It depends how you view the word determined, but I guess I'll answer it by this: with the design of the universe, if you were to look just at a single-celled animal,
mm-hmm.
Richard Dawkins in his The Blind Watchmaker said that a single-celled animal contains enough genetic information to fill 1,000 complete sets of Encyclopedia Britannica. So that's like at least 20,000 volumes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a single-celled animal, the most, the least complex of all living things. And I don't see how we can get all this information just
mm-hmm.
by chance. I mean, if we're playing a Scrabble game, and you know, I'll come out of the closet. I'm an Oakland Raider fan. If we were playing a Scrabble game, and you saw on the floor, you know, you got up and went to the restroom, and then you came back, and you saw on the floor it said Raiders rule, Seahawks stink.
Right.
You wouldn't say, "Wow, that's crazy." Phil dropped the letters.
Of course
they
not.
Just fell in that
right.
order. And so just a simple sentence like that, Raiders rule, Seahawks stink, takes intelligent intervention. You know, what makes us think that 20,000 volumes of encyclopedias worth of information is going to come about through chance? I mean, even doctors Hoyle and Wickramasinghe, they're famous for their they studied the chance of life evolving from non-life, and they found that it was so improbable that it would be the same chance. It would be just as likely as a tornado randomly running through a junkyard and producing a functional Boeing 747.
Right, but of course, I mean, I'm sure you heard people argue against that. That's obviously a false analogy, because if you're looking at the ends, or so you're putting the cart before the horse, so to speak. If you're assuming that it's supposed to create that, then obviously it would just be astronomical. But if you have billions of years of slow processes over time, inevitably forms will generate probably on its own. And there's no need, but I think we're trying to assume that we know what the end result is, but because, again, we look at, well, some would argue this isn't the end result, but we're looking at the, quote, end result, and we're thinking, aha, all this may, but we're still in transition. I mean, how would you respond to that? If we're still in a process,
yeah.
If it's still a process and we're still in transition, then isn't that analogy doesn't work, does it?
Yeah, I find evolution at this point to be take on somewhat of the mask of mythology. It seems to me that Dr. Dwayne Gish, a young Earth creationist, said that if a frog turns into a prince instantly, we call that a fairy tale.
Right.
But if we say it occurred over billions of years, we call that good science. And I don't think just with the extra time. I think the fact of the matter is, as we move forward in time, we're not going to see an increase in information without intelligent intervention.
All right. When you talk about increase in information, you're talking about in some way extra sets data or like, what are you talking about, things being added to the organism as it reproduces, you mean? Like, you won't see extra...
Some evolutionists would use mutations as the mechanism through which they claim that evolution occurred. But we know that mutations only garble the already existing genetic code. They don't add any new information. So, like, Charles Ryrie, a theologian, asked the question, where did single-celled animals get the genetic information for teeth? Because they're not there, and mutations don't produce new genetic information. They just garble the already existing genetic code.
Okay, so basically you're arguing, I guess, what they call macro versus microevolution at this point?
There's definitely gradual changes within species. And you know, the scientific definition of what a species is may differ from the biblical definition of a kind. I don't have a problem with that. You know, I don't know, you know, I would assume all dogs are related, but, you know, but whatever the case, there's going to be change within a species, within a kind.
Okay.
But like for instance, reptiles evolving into birds. I mean, you've got an entirely different design for the lung. So if one type of lung evolved into the other type of lung,
yeah.
I don't, you know, how could the thing breathe?
Okay. Well, let's talk about that for a minute. We're going to get just a little technical, but not too much. And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, hold your calls until, give me about, till 8:45. I'll start taking calls, okay? So stand by. Okay, now, how do we know that you say that, you know, dogs, or I guess, what do you believe that dogs are related to wolves, right? Do you believe that there is some type of microevolution that occurred?
Yeah, they can reproduce. Yeah.
All right. Now, how do we? Okay, we talk about you say reproduce. That has to be the factor.
No, it doesn't, because you could reach a point where, like with I don't know if it's mules or whatever, you could reach a point where something can no longer reproduce with you know, so. But I mean, I think it's obvious you take like a wolf and a dog, and they can reproduce, bear offspring, that they're in the same family. Now, if they can't bear offspring, it doesn't necessarily mean, okay, that they're not. But, you know, but I think it would be a clear sign that they are if they can bear offspring.
Okay. Yeah, because I'm pretty sure there might be some canines that might have difficulty, but I'm not sure.
There's going to be physical factors involved, obviously, with, you know, Great Dane and a Chihuahua, but...
but a fox or something like that.
And on the human, you know, when you come to the human race, there's some very little humans and some very big humans on this planet, too, so that none of us would deny that we're part of the same race.
Okay. Well, okay, I'm curious then. I'm sure you've heard of, then, endogenous retroviruses.
I've heard of them, but it's been a long time since I've looked into it again. I'm, you know, more of a philosopher of religion and
theologian. Right. Well, essentially, you know, there are some diseases or viruses that you can basically get in your sex cells, and when your parents, for instance, reproduce and have an offspring, sometimes that DNA from that virus can get passed on through sex. But because of random mutation, it can become inactive because it's not the complete genetic sequence that it was when it originally infected the host. Now that's obvious. Now that's evidence, obviously, then, that our ancestors had a virus and they passed it on to us. Now, I'm sure this is refreshing your memory as I'm going through this, but so basically, what I'm arguing here then would be, and we see this, by the way, between various canine species. That's how we obviously know certain canine species are related to others, and yada yada yada. Okay, so. We see the same thing, however, with chimpanzees and some and monkeys and other apes and stuff like that. We see that they also have similar endogenous retroviruses. We share very similar endogenous retroviruses with them. But again, I don't want to say the only way, because I'm not an expert, but I'll say probably the most common way that we can get that is through sex. So how is it then that we are getting the same genetic information if we haven't descended from an ape-like ancestor via evolution?
Yeah, I don't really know if I'm qualified to answer that, but I mean, I am aware there is, bestiality, but I don't think that's what you're getting. I think you think you're getting at what's inherited from others. But I do know, again, that there's going to be a lot of similarities in the genetic makeup of the chimpanzee and the monkey and humans. And I really don't have a problem with that. I just see that as evidence for common design, a common designer.
Okay. Let's talk about that. I mean, I'm sorry, but let's talk about that. I'm curious about this common design thing. So I would wonder, why would it be the case that God would design then, and we're supposed to be specially created, he would design other animals with the same genetic defects or same genetic, problems, you know, that humans' ancestors have had. There's also the vitamin C broken gene as well, which you probably know about as well.
Well, the genetic defects, I would not see as products of creation. I would see that as a product, more likely a product of the fall.
I know, but okay, but why would animals have that same problem? What did the animals do to God?
Oh no, I also see as God giving man dominion over the earth. That the animals are a gift to us from God, so we should treat them as gifts from God and not misuse, what God has given to us. But as the created in His image and made the stewards over the planet Earth, I believe all of creation fell when Adam and Eve fell, and so that affected the animal kingdom as well.
Wow.
Now, not all creationists agree with me. There's
sure.
I favor the young Earth creationist position, but it's based more on my understanding of Scripture than it is on scientific data.
Understood.
But there, many Christians are old Earth creationists or theistic evolutionists. I don't have a problem with that. I mean, it's trusting in Jesus alone for salvation is what makes a person a Christian. Now,
right.
So my thesis is, if evolution is true, it still needs God. But if God exists, he didn't need evolution. And now some Christians would still say he still believe he used evolution.
Well, yeah, why not? Yeah.
I'm not convinced of that myself.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm curious then. Now we can talk about going back into morality again, because I'm curious about what kind of God would punish innocent animals who had nothing to do with human affairs.
Mm-hmm.
How would you respond to that?
I really don't, I'm aware of Peter Singer and the modern animal rights movement, and,
mm-hmm.
I've got a dog, and I treat the dog real well, and probably pour too much money into the dog than I should, but, I believe in being good to animals, but I really don't see a major problem, with God deciding that, he's going to have, intelligent, moral beings, i.e. human beings, that he was going to create them to fellowship with him, and that status of the earth and the other creatures on the earth was going to stand or fall based on them. I myself don't have a problem with that. I know a lot of people right now with the animal rights movement that would be a major objection for them. But I really don't see the problem myself.
Hmm. Okay. I guess
I would see him as sovereign over his creation.
Of course, of course.
And so, are you talking about
might makes right, aren't you?
No. But he is the giver of life, and so as the giver of life, he alone has the right to take life. Now he delegates some of that authority to human authorities, such as government officials and things of that sort, but I see God as sovereign over life. So,
okay, so I guess you won't have an issue then if someone were to say God created the specific tsunami that wiped out 100,000 people. You don't have a problem with that?
Well, I think the easy Christian answer,
mm-hmm.
which a lot of my colleagues give, is that God did not produce it, he just allowed it, and maybe there are demonic forces at work or whatever, but with the fall of mankind, this could be it could have led to earthquakes or whatever, and eventually it just sets things in motion, and they think God's off the hook by just saying that he allowed it, but I think that a more serious Christian response, and then again a lot of people are not going to be real happy with this, but I think a more serious response is that whatever God allows he could have prevented, you know, because he is an all-powerful God. You know the objection that God created, or the problem of evil, where an all-good God would not want evil to exist, an all-powerful God has the ability to keep it from existing.
It's funny you say that. Yes, I have heard that.
And the Christian would say that. Mm-hmm. You know, an all-good God would not want evil to exist except for the purposes of a greater good.
See, and check this out, Phil, and this is one of the problems I have with this then, because what I'm left with then is the inability for humans to discern a good God from an evil God. Because it seems like God can do anything he wants to his creation, no matter how horrendous it is, and we'll still say, he's good. Doesn't goodness, Phil, lose its meaning at this point?
I don't think so, but there are a lot of people that do take that response. I myself would rather take the response given from the book of Job. Job was an innocent man, and he was allowed to endure tremendous suffering. And his buddy said, "Well, you must have done something bad to bring this on." And he said, "No, I didn't do anything wrong. I want to plead my case before God. You know, I question whether God keeps good records." And God shows up at the end of the book and never really gives him the answer to the problem of evil,
sure,
where God allows the innocent to suffer.
Right.
But he does tell him, like, you know, where were you, Job, when I created the universe? Where were you when I created these things? I think his overall response there is that, Job, you know enough about my goodness not to question me in the areas that you just don't understand.
See, but that doesn't work.
The perspective, it works real well with me. From my perspective,
understood.
I know so much about God's goodness.
Okay.
That when there are areas where I just can't figure it out, you know, I know when I debated Dan Barker, he wants me to reject God because I can't name the exact reason why God allowed some innocent person to suffer, and you know,
I kind of hear that, you know, it's like, hey, you know, why not? Let's give me an answer, God. Come on now.
Yeah. Well, the thing is though is, if I have my God all figured out, then it's not the God of the Bible. If I can figure out why he allows every individual case of evil,
interesting,
and the good that he can bring out of it, I'd have to be as smart as God, so my God would be too small. So it's just you know, the biblical concept of God is an infinitely wise God. I can't tell you exactly why he allowed the Holocaust. I can't tell you why he allowed 9/11 to occur.
Mm-hmm.
I'm convinced at this point in my life that I know enough about God's goodness to just trust him in areas that I don't understand. And part of the good, though, that comes out of allowing these catastrophes is for good people to take a stand and combat evil and stand up for good. This is, you know, all dealt with Albert Camus' The Plague. And I thought that was an excellent work by a very brilliant thinker, a French existentialist. But for me, it would be more problematic not being able to call evil really evil. I mean, because in every one of these examples, we're implying that things are not the way they ought to be.
Okay.
That there is a right way that things should be, and these have fallen short. So just the fact that I could look at a suffering person and say, well, it's an innocent person who's suffering, that's a product of evil, it's not the way that things should be. Just the fact that I could call it evil and then trust in God, who through Jesus' incarnation, death, resurrection, and return will defeat evil, you know, I have a hope and what I believe is a guarantee that evil will be defeated, and I can really call evil evil in the fullest sense. I mean, I asked Dan Barker if rape is wrong for all people at all times and all places, and he honestly answered me, and we debated at Bellevue Community College in Washington State, he honestly answered me no, because he knew that his atheism was consistent enough where it did not allow for universal moral laws above all people, all societies, any world consensus, and that for him to call rape wrong for all people at all times and all places, he'd be admitting to an absolute moral law, and that would be conceding too much, because then I would argue for the absolute moral lawgiver. So he acknowledged that he didn't believe it was wrong for all people at all time and all places. On that alone, that'd be enough incentive for me to reject atheism and to consider a religion Christianity.
What do you think about the story of Lot?
Mm-hmm.
Lot and his sisters, wasn't it? Or his daughters? The daughters.
Daughters.
Lot and his daughters. What do you think about that story?
Oh, I think that really strengthens the case for the Bible, because if I was going to forge a book and try to pretend it was written by God, I would have my quote-unquote saints and holy men really looking good. I wouldn't have, like, King David, a man after God's own heart, guilty of adultery and murder.
So you're saying you think that was wrong then? That still was a wrong act that
His daughters did?
Yeah. By giving his daughters...
I see what you're talking about.
Yes.
When the men of Sodom and he
yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a big mistake. Now keep in mind, the guy was... If you take the biblical account seriously, the two guys that were visiting him were angels.
Right.
So, you know, he's really intimidated. He doesn't want to tick them off, but to choose to throw his virgin daughters to these sex crazed men.
Right.
But I think that's what's so truthful about the Bible is the Bible. It shows us the dirty laundry of.
Does it condemn that? I don't remember. Does the Bible condemn that? I don't remember the Bible actually condemning that act.
I think the Bible just assumes that the reader is going to know that that's wrong just by looking at God's moral law. I mean, look at twice Abraham and I believe I can't remember if it was Jacob or if it was Isaac. I think it might have been Isaac, but twice Abraham lies about. Sarah, who was his half-sister as well as his wife, but he said that she was just his sister because he believed that the Philistines on one occasion and the Egyptians on another occasion would kill him. But
right.
I think that's just truthful reporting of the facts that Abraham, as godly as he was, had, he could really blow it too. And I think that's a warning to all of us on how dependent upon the Lord we should become.
And that's what it seems like, you know. Look at what the fear of the Lord can do to people, you know. Haha. I didn't see that as a, you know, that particular story in any way of a loving story to learn from. I mean, if anything, people should, obviously, I guess as you said, I mean, obviously, automatically, my thought is, oh, that was wrong. But again, I think
that should be the response, especially when we look at God's commands in the scriptures. And then it's never followed with, Abraham lied about his wife, and Lot tried to throw his two virgin daughters to these sex crazed men.
Right.
And therefore go and do likewise. There is no therefore go and do likewise. I think it was just showing that you could take a quote-unquote righteous man like Lot and place them in Sodom and Gomorrah and how influenced by their culture they could be. And that's why the Apostle Paul says bad company corrupts good morals.
Okay.
Now, Jesus could walk among the sinful and influence them for the good without being influenced by them for the bad. We need to be careful. We need to make sure we don't outrun God and put ourselves in situations where all of a sudden they're influencing us for the bad rather than us influencing others for the good.
Okay. Now, earlier you mentioned something about you thought it would be evident for Job, going back to this, excuse me, I took some notes on this, about him seeing, being evident in him seeing God's goodness, so why would he question the bad things that happened to him, whatever. But when you, automatically, though, you think about your own family. I mean, my mother and my dad have shown me plenty of love, but if my dad were to just pull up in the driveway and pull out a gun and start blowing me away, and if I were lucky enough to survive, I don't think I'd call him a very loving God anymore. I would probably say, well, he was loving. Why don't we apply that same standard to God?
Well, I think one thing, we're adults and we're intelligent adults, but when you compare us with God, the gap between our intelligence and God's is so much greater. I'll give you an example. When I worked in law enforcement, there was a gentleman who told me that his son had some kind of deformity on his male organ.
Whoa.
And so he would basically, he couldn't urinate properly and stuff, and so it took a number of surgeries that he had to go through and to try to correct the problem.
Okay.
And he was in tremendous pain, and this guy would hear his son crying in the middle of the night.
Oh, come on.
And then one night he walked up and saw his son, and his son was in the corner standing naked, holding himself and weeping, and he was crying, and he cried out to his father. He said, "Why? Why do you allow them to do this to me?"
Right.
And,
good question.
And there's a good answer. His father has access to more information than he does, and knows that he needs this surgery to properly be able to urinate, because there's going to be all kinds of medical issues if not. And the father was allowing him to go through a tremendous amount of suffering and pain for purposes of a greater good.
Which we don't know.
And I think that's the way...
But we don't know what a greater good is, though. So why say that if you don't even know what a greater good is?
You could, the father could explain it to his little boy, and his little boy still didn't understand.
What?
But deep down inside, I think even his little boy, you know, would question his father, but knew, hey, this is the guy that feeds me. This is the guy who plays catch with me, plays ball with me. This is the guy who loves me. And I don't understand why he's allowing these people to do these surgeries on me.
Well, he's in pain.
I think ultimately the little kid trusted him. But I think next to God, I think we are kids. I think, we think we're going to figure out the entire universe. We don't even have this planet figured out. So
it's interesting you admit that. So if you admit our ignorance when it comes to even understanding the very nature of God itself, then you can see then you could be wrong about everything you think you know about God.
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that
really?
I believe that we can have true knowledge of God, both from nature and also revealed supernaturally, such as things like the scriptures, that we can have true knowledge of God, but we can never have exhaustive knowledge of God. In other words, we can never know God fully. I mean, if you just write it out on a piece of paper,
I understand.
Infinitely wise God and finitely wise human, you know, we're never going to catch up to God in all his wisdom and knowledge.
Okay. And it's interesting enough, and for me, I think that it's pretty much evident to me that because the scope of the universe and everything I've the minuscule amount of what I've learned about the universe was still enough for me to decide that Yahweh just does not exist. You know, and that's pretty much where I am. We have, ladies and gentlemen, we have 7 minutes here to the top of the hour and end of the program. Unfortunately, well, I didn't get a chance to take many of your calls. I will take calls right now. I don't know if... Phil, do you have another maybe 15 minutes you can spend with us?
Yo, sure.
Okay,
sure.
Okay, good. What we're going to do is I'm going to stop the feed, but we're going to jump over into my video chat room, and we'll go for another 15 minutes, and I'll take some calls there. I got a question. Earlier you talked about free will. I pretty much asked this of every Christian guest I've had, so I have to ask you as well. The Adam and Eve story. Now, this is a biggie for me. This doesn't really make much sense to me. How you have a deity that's all-knowing,
mm-hmm.
okay? He has a divine plan. He creates the universe knowing exactly how it's all going to unfold.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he creates Adam and Eve knowing exactly what free will would do if he gave it to them. They do exactly what he planned them to do. And he put the trees there. He didn't have to. He puts them there. And then he punishes human beings until Jesus returns.
Mm-hmm.
What's the deal there, Phil?
Well, I think foreknowledge, and William Lane Craig has done a lot of work on this, but foreknowledge does not necessarily mean that God forced somebody to act in a particular way.
That's not what I'm arguing, Phil.
And so no, but it's the first thing that I think needs to be said is that
just the
fact that God foreknows how humans would misuse the choices he gave them doesn't mean that he made them do it. So first off, I hold to libertarian free will. I do believe that Adam and Eve really had free choice. I believe we really have free choice. And so that's the thing I'd like to state first. Now, God foreknowing what's going to occur, he also has the ability, and I think this is going to touch more on your question, Reggie,
okay.
and what I said there, but I think it just lays the groundwork for it. But God having perfect foreknowledge of what would occur had Adam and Eve been in that situation, for him to allow it means... that, you know, he's got the power to prevent it from happening. I mean, he could have just decided, look, they're going to fall. I'm just not going to create them.
Exactly. That makes a lot of sense to me, Phil.
Yeah. Well, but I think that God predetermined that, hey, look, I know if I put them in these circumstances, they're going to do the wrong thing. It's going to bring about a lot of bad circumstances, a lot of bad consequences, I should say.
He did it anyway.
But I'm going to bring a greater good out of it. And
which is,
Well, I think there's a lot of things. Well, number one, if God created us as robots, we wouldn't even have free will. And I don't.
See, but he already had angels to do that, though. But he already had angels up there with free will that would give him a hard time. Look at Lucifer.
Yeah, but there's no salvation for angels, so.
But if we never display his grace. See, but Phil, but if we never existed, we wouldn't have any salvation to achieve.
Well, I don't even think we achieve salvation. I think that's achieved by Christ, and then we either accept it
or to gain or to give, or whatever. Yes.
Yeah, I think if I go out and just try to bring glory to myself all the time, I think that's wrong and it's egotistical. But if I were God, I think that's what it's about. I mean, you're the ultimately worthy being and deserving of worship, and so I think God allows certain things to occur to bring a greater good out of it. And one of them is that God is glorified, and another will be that humans and angels will spend eternity with God because they freely chose to be with Him for all eternity.
Yeah, and I thought that was weird too. He would have had to have known that Satan was going to fall, or the serpent he created. Again, you know, there's a debate between whether or not that was Satan or not in the garden. I think it was just a serpent. But anyway, some crafty creature, he allows him in the garden for one thing, and then he allows the creature, in fact, he would have foreknown this. This is where, I notice we keep having this, he keeps saying, well, just because he knew, he didn't force.
Well,
but if he had a divine plan, he would have to know exactly what free will would do to human beings, and he gives it to them anyway, and then he gets all bent out of shape about it. That's the part I don't get.
Well,
why all the emotionalism, Phil?
Yeah, well, and it's, you know, I could see a father lending the keys of his car to his son, and really thinking deep down inside, you know, I don't think he can handle this responsibility. I'm going to give him opportunity to prove himself, but I don't think he can handle this. And if he doesn't, you know, and the father might say, well, I knew this was going to happen, but I think the father is still perfectly right to voice his disapproval. But as far as with, you know, you get movie directors that will say, well, I don't believe in God, and this is not the best possible world, or this or that, blah, blah, blah. But then they try to make the best possible movie. And you have
I can create a better God, Phil.
Well, I'm sure you think you can, and I'm sure Dan Barker thinks that I'm nicer than God because I wouldn't have allowed.
In my view, Phil, God would not create anything. There's no need to create anything.
But here's the, well, I'm glad he did create me, because I'm going to enjoy, you know, if fellowship with him.
Well, I'm here already. If God exists, hey, I'm here already. I'm enjoying life. I admit that. I am here. But if I wasn't here, would I care? No. And I don't see why he would care either if we worship him or not. He should be beyond this rather king, this very finite, humanistic, you know, want, it seems like to me.
No, but let me get back to my illustration. So the movie producer says that this is not the best possible world. I could have done a better job. But then he tries to make the best possible movie, and you have some beautiful princess, and then you have a horrible dragon or a horrible villain, and then in the end her prince returns and slays the dragon, rescues his bride, and they live happily ever after. And often, you know, as you go through the plot of these movies, it almost sounds like the gospel message. And you know, make a movie with absolutely no evil in it, and see how many people are going to go and watch it. And I think people want to see a resolution of evil.
Well,
they want to see evil defeated.
Still, yeah, I know, but it's still at the same time though. Like hopefully we do. We know that it's fake, and yeah, we like it to stimulate us because we like to let it stimulate us because we're not all knowing. We don't know all the variables involved, and we're learning something new every time we see it, even multiple times, etc. It's a new experience for us. I'm like, what is God experiencing if He's all knowing? Before you answer that, let's take this call. By the way, we're at the top of the hour now on the Shoutcast stream. Feel free to move on over now to Stick Cam. We got Wrath and the Response Squad coming up next. I'll see you in the video room. All right, so let's take this call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, thank you for holding.
No problem. I have two questions for our guest.
Sure.
The first being, looking back at your Scrabble analogy, would you say that if I took all the Scrabble pieces, threw them down on the ground, and if I did it 5 billion times, would it never ever say Raiders suck, Seahawks, or Raiders rule, Seahawks suck? Would that never happen if I did it 5 billion times?
No, I don't know. Maybe it would, but... we're talking about 20,000 complete sets of encyclopedia, that much information. How many times you gonna have to, just to get a single celled animal, how many times you gonna have to throw it down for that?
But like after time limit, certain times supply, the odds of it raised. Chance of getting a royal flush is very slim. But
yeah.
Sooner or later, if you play enough hands, you'll get a royal flush.
Yeah, time is the evolution is best friend, because they don't see any of this stuff that they claim has been going on. They don't see any of it going on now, so they just say, well, just wait a couple billion years and it'll happen. And I hear this time and time again, but I just don't find that a strong argument. I don't see how natural laws plus chance plus time is ever going to produce more complex information, especially to the degree that we need to see a single-celled animal, let alone something like the human brain, which we're told contains enough information to fill at least 20 million.
But you're saying, okay, but you're appealing to, okay, so we don't know these things yet. But that doesn't mean that, okay, since we might not know or might not ever know, it must be what you think it is. Very quickly, let me give a quick quote here by Hippocrates, who said, people think that epilepsy is divine simply because they don't have any idea what causes epilepsy. But I believe that someday we will understand what causes epilepsy, and at that moment, we will cease to believe that it's divine. And so, and so it is with everything in the universe. Hippocrates 5.
And that's the accusation of atheistic evolutionists made on Christians called the God of the Gaps, that there's a gap in our knowledge. So we just put God in there. I don't think so. I think it's scientific. When we examine nature, intelligent minds produce complex, highly complex, well-ordered things. For instance, the Big Bang. Do we really believe that this explosion, the Big Bang, somehow caused all the order and complexity in the universe? That's not a scientific statement. Explosions take things from a state of disorder. I mean, take things from a state of order to a state of disorder. They don't go in the other way around. Look at the Oklahoma City building. It didn't gain order from an explosion. So random explosions take things from a state of order to a state of disorder, not the other way around. Yet that's exactly what atheistic evolution.
Well, I don't think many people argue what you're saying. I haven't heard anyone say it quite like that. And I've had quite a number of physicists on my program. That's not exactly what they'd say if something blew up into something. So it's kind of
they commonly use the analogy of the Big Bang as everything, the universe kind of exploding into existence.
Right, but even if they didn't,
somehow
Phil,
even
if we're all wrong, even if the Big Bang is false, but of course I think there's a lot of evidence that shows at least there was some explosion an expansion that helps, I don't know what it does, move matter around and create matter, I don't know, I'm not a physicist, but I know there's some evidence that there was some expansion in the past, might be multiple ones for all we know, but just because, even if we're completely wrong about that, of course you do admit that doesn't mean that, well, that doesn't mean that there must be God then.
So even with the second law of thermodynamics, we could still argue for the beginning of the universe, and then there's philosophical arguments that I think that are really strong for the beginning of the universe as well. Most cosmologists, most astrophysicists acknowledge that the universe had a beginning, and I'm of the opinion that from nothing, nothing comes. Non-being cannot cause being.
Well, our universe.
So if there's an absolute beginning of the universe, everything that has a beginning needs a cause. The universe had a beginning, therefore the universe needs a cause.
Except,
wouldn't God need the same cause?
Exactly, because you utilize the classical.
You're
saying everything needs a cause.
No.
The God too.
No. I didn't say that. No, I said everything that has a beginning needs a cause. And I'm sure there's probably a lot of Christians running around saying everything needs a cause,
which is the classical cosmological argument. That was one of the original classical cosmological arguments, wasn't it? I mean, what you're arguing is the Kalam cosmological argument.
Neither Aquinas. Aquinas was talking about a cause for the existential causality, a cause for the continuing existence of the universe. It's a totally different thing. And Leibniz was arguing for a sufficient explanation for things, so in other words, Leibniz's self-explained being would be an uncaused cause. It would not be a self-caused cause. Now there's some Christian scholars like Norman Geisler that disagree with me on my interpretation of Leibniz, but I give Leibniz the benefit of the doubt. It seems to me that Leibniz is saying something different than Dr. Okay. Geisler thinks he's saying.
Look, call. Let's take some more phone calls. I'm sorry, okay? Let's take some more calls.
Okay, sure.
Thank you for calling in. All right, ladies and gentlemen, don't forget 888-503-0802. You want to go ahead and give us a call. I know some people still listening through Stick Cam on my chat room page, and also people looking through the video room right now. I really appreciate it. Okay, I forgot now. I had a question. I totally forgot what it was now, but that's okay. We'll move on.
Let me just say this real quick,
sure.
Reggie. I really appreciate, you know, because I'll be totally honest with you. I thought I was being set up tonight. And, you know, you just assume that when you dialogue with people who come from a different perspective than you have.
Mm-hmm.
And I really want to thank you for your graciousness. And you've been a very gracious host, and I'm enjoying our conversation. And, you know, I look forward to the day. Maybe we can sit down and have a cup of coffee.
Okay, I just hope God doesn't tell you to sacrifice me. I'm just kidding. Just kidding.
Well, and I like your sense of humor, too.
Okay, we got another guy on the phone here.
Okay.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, Reggie Hazel, how's it going?
Hey, pretty good.
I was just watching your debate with Jeff Lauder. I thought it was really good. You guys did a good job. You're talking a lot about seeking the truth and everything, and I've been trying to do that for the past few months.
Mm-hmm.
And especially with the issue of evolution, I just really feel like as I seek out more and more, the evidence is pretty conclusive that evolution is a fact, that just about every scientific, agency, every scientific association, and just about every respectable scientist believes in. So, I mean, Phil, my question to you is what should I do with that information now that I have it? I don't know how I could possibly reject it.
Yeah, that's a very good statement. I also like the way you said that just about every scientist, because there are good scientists like Kurt Wise, who received his PhD at Harvard under Stephen Jay Gould. He's either a geologist or a paleontologist, but he's a creationist. So it's not every scientist, but I would agree that most scientists at this point. In fact, I think that's the strongest argument for evolution is that most scientists and the scientific community as a general statement promotes atheist or at least evolution.
That's a horrible argument.
I think that's actually the strongest statement, but to me it sounds almost like an infallible pope has spoken. So I would like us to test authorities, but let me recommend to the caller says he's seeking truth. I'm reading a book that, again, I'm a young Earth creationist, but I've got colleagues that are old Earth creationists, theistic evolutionists. I'm reading a book that I saw the guy on C-SPAN named Francis Collins.
Yes.
He wrote The Language of God, A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief.
Yep.
And he is a theistic evolutionist, and he's a brilliant man. He headed the Human Genome Project.
Yep.
So he's one of the world's leading geneticists, and he has a vibrant Christian faith, a vibrant belief in
mm-hmm.
God,
yeah.
and Jesus as a Savior. Yet he's a theistic evolutionist, and he actually, I think he would be rather embarrassed by my creationist views, and maybe even some of the old Earth creationist views. But I don't feel it's my lifelong goal to turn evolutionist into creationist. It's my goal to try to, in love, persuade people to accept Jesus Christ as their Savior. And if they end up Christians who are theistic evolutionists like Francis Collins, I don't really have a problem with that. I mean, if we sat down, we would probably argue for a while, but,
mm-hmm.
He's the head of the Human Genome Project, and I was lucky to get an A in biology. So, I mean,
mm-hmm.
I'm not going to lock horns with the guy on scientific issues, but I'm not about trying to make everybody the exact kind of Christian that I am, but I would love to see. I really believe that I'm a beggar who found bread. I really believe that I found the pot of gold. I found the truth in the Lord Jesus Christ, and it's my desire to lead others to Christ. And if they're theistic evolutionists, they're old Earth creationists, that's not a big deal with me.
Wow. Well, I mean, what if you're wrong?
I would answer that by, what if you're wrong?
I'm perfectly fine with that.
You're perfectly fine with me, because if I'm wrong and you're right.
Well, that's not what I said.
And we both die. Let's say we're together and something bad happens. Lots of bad things happen in the world. We're together and we both die. If you're right, you can't even say, see, Phil, I was right. But if I'm right, you know, and it tears at my heart, you know, if I'm right, you know, there is eternity of joy with the Lord, and then there's eternal torment, eternal separation from God, who is the source of
that
joy.
That is horrible. And it's amazing that you'll feel for me for that. But and it's amazing that you'll feel sad because of that. I mean, you would want to, I've often wondered, and two issues here is that it seems like you are more loving than God, one. And then the second issue would be, how would that be heaven then for you if you knew that I was burning forever in hell?
The second question I can't answer because I've got loved ones who have died, relatives and friends who have died and without knowing Jesus. So when Jesus says he's going to wipe away every tear and remove all our sorrow and all our pain, you know, I'm glad he's God because I can't figure out how he's going to do that.
I know, right?
So I'm leaving that to him. Now, the first part of your question, though, what was that?
And by the way, that's powerful enough for me, by the way, for me to reject acceptance of that, because that issue is a biggie for me, by the way.
I don't see God sending people to hell.
Really?
All I see hell as is eternal separation from God.
Well, I'm living that way now.
And angels go there because they don't want to be with God. They reject God and they don't want to be with him. And so, you know, that's their choice. I think it would actually be...
That's strange, though.
I think it would actually be crueler for God to say, well, you're not getting with my program, so I'm gonna remove you from existence.
That'd be actually better.
Well,
because you wouldn't know it.
I'll be totally honest with you, though. You know, it's like, you know, I'm not the God of the universe, so I can't say there's a door number three. And from my understanding, from my studying philosophy, studying the world's religions, from studying theology,
mm-hmm.
it seems that there's only two doors. And if we don't want to spend eternity worshiping with God, then we'll be eternally separated from God. And people might think that's a good thing, but I don't think it's a good thing at all.
And I can't remember my first point now, but it's funny, when you say that, it's really sad and to me, the belief, because what you're saying here then, I should ask you, instead of assuming, now, you said that these people don't want to be with God. These angels and demons and humans who just didn't believe in him, you believe they're rejecting him, so therefore they are where they are. It's their fault, pretty much. But there are plenty of people who have other religions and believe in other things simply because they're brought up that way. They're in the tradition. Many haven't even been adequately exposed to Christianity. And what about people? I'm a genuine non-believer. I put Yahweh in the same class as I do Santa Claus. In fact, Santa Claus is more clout than Yahweh because at least we know Saint Nicholas existed.
Way to find a philosopher to defend the existence of Santa Claus.
Well, there are some websites out there, believe it or not, but no, Phil. But so that's a big, and that's a problem for me as well. Is how would you address that?
Well, first thing I'd say is that we humans, we tend to stick with the culture that we're with and the religion that we're with and things of that sort. At the same time, you know, we've got to face the facts. There's over 300 million Bible-believing Christians who in Southern African countries, in Central and South American countries,
mm-hmm.
and in Asian countries and Eastern countries.
Right.
So, I mean, these people, I mean, we're talking nearly a billion people having radical conversions from other religions. So the idea that we all just kind of stick with the religion, or most of us stick with the religion that we're brought up in, there's an awful lot of radical conversions to Christianity. That's one thing I would state.
But that is common. I would say that's not absolute, but that is very common, though, of course. Typically, you believe what your parents believe.
Yeah, and then if we try to... You know, suppose people say, "Well, you know, Fernandez is just needs a crutch and this and that." And you know, I used to think I didn't need anybody. I used to think I was a tough guy. I used to think I was self-sufficient.
I never thought that way.
But I reached the point where I recognized my absolute dependency on God. And
I never thought that way.
But well, see, and
I don't understand. I mean, it's not like you're making it. It's almost like Phil. It's almost like I'm setting it up, saying, "Look, this is the world. This is, you know, Christianity." And I used to think this way, which is of the world. Wait a minute, I'm in the world, Phil, and I never thought that way. I always knew that people depend on.
And you know, I'm talking to an atheist. I know that. I know most people on the planet Earth don't think the way that I think. But you have to understand as well, you know, when we talk about evidence, that's one thing. When we talk about our subjective experience, that's another thing. Then we have to see our subjective experiences, are they based on the evidence? And that's what an interview like this is about. But I give a red ping pong ball illustration.
Okay.
And where I basically say that I have a classroom. I teach high school, and I teach a little college on the side. But I teach at a Christian high school, and I say that suppose that there was my room was filled with white ping pong balls from the floor to the ceiling. You'd open the door, and ping pong balls start falling out, and kids would come in, and they'd wade through the ping pong balls, and they'd see white ping pong balls. But one day, little Johnny comes through, and he's wading through the white ping pong balls, and he finds a red ping pong ball. And he says, "Wow, there's a red ping pong ball. But I better put it back where I found it because it belongs to Doc. It's in his classroom. I've got no right to take it." So he puts it back, and then he leaves the room, and he tells others about the red ping pong ball. And then others start saying, "Well, the red ping pong ball doesn't exist because I haven't experienced it." And then others may look in, and they look around, and they don't find it. And so they say, "Well, no, it hasn't." And I don't think that's a...
That is invalid. You're right. That's not valid.
And so...
That's why I don't use that argument.
Now, the question is... Is this little Johnny guy, or whatever name I gave to him, was his experience of the red ping pong ball, was it a real experience, or was he hallucinating, or whatever else it might be? And that's where we have interviews like this. That's why we have debates and dialogues. But I think I'm perfectly within my epistemic rights to say that I hold to certain beliefs in Jesus. I came to Christ for a lot of subjective reasons, but then I began to check those subjective experiences, and I believe I found enough evidence to make a case that my subjective beliefs are true. And so that's we're talking about like apples and oranges.
Mm-hmm.
When you know, when some of the questions will deal with, well, what do I subjectively believe,
right?
And then how do I defend that? And I realize that a lot of people aren't just going to take my word for it. I wouldn't take the word of a Buddhist or a Hindu who believes he's become one with God. I would want to see some evidence, and from my looking at the evidence, I believe Hinduism is false and Christianity
is true. Right. And they think the same thing, of course, obviously, of Christianity. Now, we haven't even gotten to the whole crux of Christianity yet, so I think we need to spend some time on Jesus Christ and what evidence is there. Very, very quickly about his existence and stuff like that. But right before we jump into that, when the last caller called in about evolution, so I want to bring this up before I forget. Also, I'm sure, have you heard of, well, I don't want to get too technical here because it's not really, but I believe the article I read was talking about, I don't know if it was a wild chicken or something, it was called a talpid, and they discovered these chicken in a wild that were growing teeth, reptilian teeth. Did you hear about this?
No, did not hear about it.
Okay, well, it's interesting that we discovered that evolution is correct, as you know, this is what you predict. If evolution is correct, then there should be genes that would express themselves now and again in species over time. You'd expect these things to happen. So sure enough, we found this in talpids. Now, the interesting thing about this is that even in common chickens, we can actually stimulate, not inject them with genes, I mean just stimulate certain genes to get them to express reptilian teeth as well. Now, evolution, in the purview of evolution, that makes perfect sense because, as you know, the theory suggests that birds came from or descended from reptilian creatures. So, how does creationism explain things like that?
Oh, I don't know. I think we're going to be finding a lot of strange things, which from our perspective will be strange, that are based on God's creation or aspects of the fall. So I certainly don't claim to have all the answers, but to call teeth in a chicken reptilian teeth, I think begs the question. And I think evolution is, you know, Archaeopteryx turned out to be a failure.
No,
and I think
actually it did not. Archaeopteryx didn't turn out to be a failure. How did Archaeopteryx turn out to be a failure? And you know, they've even found a complete fossil recently.
There isn't a feature of Archaeopteryx that isn't found in some type of bird. Now, the combination of all of them is rather unique to the bird family. But
they found tons of intermediates now, by the way. They found tons of intermediates now, by the way.
That's not
true. You're talking about 19. You're still in 1940s.
No. I would disagree with you there. But whatever the case, I think Archaeopteryx is pretty well been classified as a bird, not a reptile.
Phil, you know you're ignoring the reptilian features, though. You can't deny that they have reptilian-like features.
You call them reptilian features, but you know we have ostriches with claws. We have all sorts of of birds that have some of these features, and the Archaeopteryx has a lot of them. But to call them reptilian features, I think begs the question. I think it's that you have a common designer. Mm-hmm. Who designed birds and who designed reptiles.
But you're missing the point, though.
Some of these creatures are kind of hard to categorize. Yeah, I don't see a problem with
that. No, but I mean, all of them have them. It's just it just expressed themselves. My point is that they have beaks. If chickens are their own kind, of their own, they shouldn't be having teeth at all. They can't just come about unless there is something in place. I guess you could argue the fall again, but like Kenneth Miller would argue, you know, God isn't a liar. Why would God put these things in place if it's not true?
Yeah, well,
if evolution isn't true.
Again, you know, and I don't. It's probably going to sound to you like I'm avoiding the issue, but
yeah.
I mean, it's just where I feel led. I mean, I as I said earlier, I favor young Earth creationism, and primarily because of my understanding of the scriptures, and I'm not as convinced. I'm nowhere near as convinced as you are about the supposed scientific evidence. For evolution, but you know, I've got many Christian colleagues who are old Earth creationists. C.S. Lewis was a theistic evolutionist, and you could argue with me the evolution point till I'm blue in the face. But as far as I'm concerned, the main issue is does God exist? And so,
okay.
I'm not trying to avoid the question, but I'm basically saying, you know, we're getting a little out of my field of expertise.
Understood.
And I, you know, if my grandsons turn out to be Christians who love the Lord, but who are theistic evolutionists, I'll still be a happy camper.
Okay. And the only reason I brought up those instances, of course, is because I know that you do have some criticisms against evolution. So I thought I'd bring up three of the ones that I give in my lectures that actually wholly, you know, convince people that there's more to this than they thought.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I brought up three of the powerful ones today. But anyway, okay, we have 10 minutes left. Thank you for giving me a full 30 minutes on this one, past the hour. We have Christianity, again, but I guess it's good that we did get some background. We talked about some of the problems I have and then your rebuttals, and you know, and I think we covered a lot of ground. So now let's talk about the man, Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
He's the cornerstone of Christianity.
Yeah.
You're a Christian. Tell us about Jesus, and why do you think these stories are true?
Well, I think that the basic argument against Christianity, even on the scholarly level, basic argument against having reliable evidence of or reliable testimony about Jesus, it pretty much runs like this: apart from all your eyewitness testimony, you don't have a case. But I would argue eyewitness testimony is a good case. I mean, as far left as New Testament scholars get, that's called the Jesus Seminar, a very small branch, radical
yes.
small branch
mm-hmm.
of New Testament scholarship. Yet even they acknowledge that Paul wrote most of his writings. You know, they don't acknowledge all of the of Paul's writings as from Paul, as I do. But they acknowledge that Paul wrote from about 50 to the 60s A.D. So he wrote in the 50s and the 60s A.D. So you're getting to from 20 to 30 years after Jesus supposedly died and rose from the dead. And Paul has a full-blown Christology where he teaches that Jesus is God incarnate, that he died on the cross for our sins, that he's the Jewish Messiah, that he bodily rose from the dead. And, you know, Paul taught all of these things. Now, with the Jesus Seminar, Marcus Borg, I Camps Crusade for Christ,
mm-hmm.
challenged him to debate me, but he's a very busy guy and a very important guy, and he probably never even heard of me. He's at Oregon State University, so it never really materialized, so I went down there and spoke unopposed. But Marcus Borg would acknowledge that Paul teaches those things, but then he would say, however, Paul was an innovator.
That's
and,
right.
And that's where I would differ. And right there I would say, you know, if I have to choose between the Jesus Seminar coming on the scene 2,000 years later or the Apostle Paul 20 years after the fact, and the Apostle Paul was willing to be persecuted for this, so we know that he was sincere about his beliefs, if I got to choose between the two, I'm going to side with Paul based on that alone. But I think we have more data than that. Paul, the Jesus Seminar, most of the members that I've read acknowledge, well, I've only read a few of their leading members, but it seems that they acknowledge that Paul wrote Galatians.
Yes,
in Galatians,
I heard that. Mm-hmm.
Chapters 1 and chapter 2, Paul says that basically in the 30s A.D., he visited with the Jerusalem church with Peter and James. It's also recorded in the book of Acts. And then he met with them again in the mid-40s A.D., and they extended the right hand of fellowship to Paul and Barnabas, acknowledging that he was preaching the same gospel message that they were preaching. And so it seems to me that if Paul is preaching a gospel message of a fully divine Jesus...
Well, he didn't have the entire story, as you know.
What's that?
He didn't have the entire story. There's a lot of events missing, but, of course, as you know.
I don't think we... I think we assume a lot of events are missing. We have to understand Paul wrote letters. He didn't write a gospel.
Right.
He was a colleague of Luke, and I think we can make a strong case that Luke was the author of the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts. I know the Jesus Seminar would differ on that, but I would love the challenge of debating any of their members on that particular issue.
Hey, sounds good.
Hey, that would be great. that would be super, because I don't know why such an exciting book like Acts, which was the sequel to Luke, would end so anticlimactically with Paul in Rome under house arrest for 2 years. And it just ends anticlimactically. Why not tell us about the temple that was destroyed in 70 A.D.? It played such a big role in Acts. Why not tell us about James, the half-brother of Jesus, and how he was thrown from the temple and put to death in 62 A.D.? He plays a big role in Acts. He's not mentioned.
This is all the Bible.
Their deaths are not mentioned. It seems to me that this was all written
in the Bible.
It's like somebody writes a history of Manhattan, and the book ends with the Twin Towers still standing. I think the first thing that should, especially if it ends anticlimactically, first thing that should enter into our minds is, that was this written before 9/11, 2001? And I think that's the case they record the author of Acts records the death of Stephen, some guy who just pops into the book and then just dies.
Okay.
And then it records the death of James, the brother of John, two insignificant guys. Why not mention the deaths of Peter, Paul, and James, the three leading characters of the book of Acts? I think it's safe to say it ends anticlimactically in 61 A.D., a year before James died, because that's when the author sealed the letter and then mailed it off to Theophilus.
Okay. You give us some history, and unfortunately we don't have all night to go over all the history, but my question still would be, you're quoting a lot of stuff out of the Bible, okay? Why do you believe that those stories themselves in the Bible are true in the first place?
Well, right there, just what I stated, I talked about what the Bible spoke about and what the Bible doesn't speak about, such as the book of Acts.
Right.
And then to make a case that Acts was written right about 61 A.D., it's the sequel of Luke. Luke probably had to be written earlier than that. And so basically what I'm doing is I'm arguing that these books were written by either eyewitnesses who knew Jesus or people who interviewed eyewitnesses who knew Jesus. I mean, Papias, the apostolic father. Apostolic fathers were pupils of the apostles, selected by the apostles to lead the early church. Papias tells us that Mark got his gospel from Peter's preaching. He was a colleague of Peter in Rome, and he got his gospel from the preaching of Peter. Papias lived from about 60 A.D. to about 140 A.D. Papias also tells us that...
long after, okay.
What's that?
Yeah, nice.
Not really. Not really, not at all, because, 60 A.D., I mean, you can go to Ignatius. You want something better, I'll give you something better. 107 A.D. was when he was fed to wild beasts, and he wrote seven letters. And he constantly referred to Jesus as our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ. He said he truly suffered in the flesh, truly died in the flesh.
How would they know this stuff? They're all dead.
Well, but see, he was trained by the Apostle John. And then he was selected to be bishop of Antioch.
Okay, Phil, this is the position I'm in. Then how do we know that they just make these questions up in the first place?
Well,
this whole story could be messed, and they're just passing stories.
If you handled any other ancient history like this, you would have to toss it. Because first you reject the eyewitness accounts because you say, I don't believe they're written by eyewitnesses. So then we go to
How many sources do we have? How many people do you have acknowledging the story that were contemporaries at the time? That's what comes to my mind.
That's not the way you do ancient history. Ancient history, you don't have the wealth of sources that you find in the New Testament. But you have the New Testament sources, and so
I find that strange.
We don't believe that these guys really experienced what they said they experienced and saw what they said they saw. So then we show you the pupils of these guys, selected by them to lead the early church, and they say the same thing. And then you say that's not good enough. But we've got an unbroken chain that goes all the way back. We've got
an unbroken chain. I don't understand. What do you mean there's an unbroken? I haven't heard you say anything about anybody's writing anything about Jesus. I mean, immediately after his death, it was always like 30, 60 years after the fact.
Well, I would date some of the books much earlier than that. But even if I give you that 30 to 60 years after the fact, if a guy rose from the dead, you're going to forget it 30 years later. If you believe he's,
I would write it down. I probably would have wrote it down the same day.
I think the number one, somebody might have. Okay, I personally believe that Matthew, as a former tax collector, would have been the stenographer. He would have at least taken notes on Jesus' sermons. Papias seems to imply that. He said that Matthew's gospel was originally written in Hebrew and later translated to Greek. He calls it the Logia, that means the words of Jesus. But whatever the case, I actually think that the gospels were written much earlier. But even if you say 30 to 60 years, we're still pushing things back incredibly close. I mean, you're not going to forget about whether or not Jesus really did rise from the dead and really did appear to you, and then be willing to die for that.
Yes, you would.
Even if it's 30 years later. I mean, if you're going to be willing to die for
people will die for the craziest. People will sacrifice themselves for the craziest things, Phil. You know that. A wacko can claim he's a savior in Waco tomorrow.
And he'll
have people willing to die for him.
Yeah, when an Islamic
in one generation, Phil.
An Islamic fundamentalist, you know, flies into a building and does it in the name of Allah because he believes that proves that he sincerely believes that Muhammad is God's prophet.
Okay? Right.
Well, I disagree with that, and I don't think the evidence is good at all being the prophet. However,
but they're willing to die for
it, the early church, you have them dying because they believe they saw Jesus risen from the dead. I think that's a lot harder to explain. How they could sincerely believe that Jesus rose from the dead, but they were mistaken.
For
the past 2,000 years, guys have had a hard time coming up with an alternative, naturalistic explanation. The hallucination theory has been shot down. The wrong tomb theory.
I wouldn't use hallucination. I'd probably say maybe they're deceived. But I mean, one of my biggest issues.
But how would they be deceived?
Or misinterpreting or misunderstanding or.
Okay,
they simply could have made it up.
Simply made it up and then died for
those
lies.
Yes, because there's no witnesses. There are no witnesses that wrote anything.
No witnesses. That's a big assumption on your part. Right there, you have to call the author.
I would ask
Luke,
you, where is it?
Liar. What's that?
Oh, Luke. Okay,
Luke claimed that he talked with eyewitnesses. He did his research. The apostle
he
John
talked with eyewitnesses. Right. He claims he talked. Maybe he did lie.
Mm-hmm. I doubt that very much with the sufferings that he would go through, I don't question the sincerity of a man who dies for his faith, but I want to know, okay, what did he sincerely believe? And that Muhammad being a prophet, I think that's easy to refute. But to say people sincerely believe they saw Jesus alive after his death and died for that, I have a hard time seeing how they could have been wrong, and the fact of the matter is New Testament scholarship has had a hard time trying to figure out how they could be born.
All right.
Wrong.
Now,
let me say this. You're going to have Dr. Gary Habermas, one of my former professors from Liberty University, and Mike Lacona, one of his former students, on in a couple weeks, and I love this subject, but you're going to have a lot of time to talk with Dr. Habermas.
That sounds good. Now, lastly, isn't there a story, again, I'm weak on my Bible, isn't there a story about when Jesus was resurrected or something? Wasn't like a lot of people raised from the dead, like there were zombies running around or something like that? Or
that's when Jesus was crucified. Matthew's gospel, I believe it's the only gospel that records it, that apparently they're referred to as saints, so apparently those who were trusting in Jesus for salvation, so in Jerusalem there might have only been like a couple dozen of them. It wasn't a whole lot of people,
right?
But these were people who had been freshly buried, kind of a Lazarus type thing, but probably may not have even spent 4 days in the tomb, but they rose and they presented themselves alive. A lot of weird things happened. The veil in the temple tore from the top.
And that
to
doesn't sound like mythology to you, folklore, storytelling.
No, you know what it sounds like? It sounds like a good explanation as to how Peter, a fisherman, could preach a message 50 days after Jesus' crucifixion and 3,000 people get saved. Sounds to me like on the Feast of Pentecost, the same people were there that were there 50 days earlier when Jesus of Nazareth was crucified, and they were wondering how come it got dark.
The
veil in the temple was torn from the top to the bottom.
That would have been something to write about.
Came back to light.
That would have been something to write about, Phil.
We want to know. We want to know why that occurred.
Even the Romans would have wrote that.
Peter preached it's because God raised him from the dead, proving that he is the anointed one, the Messiah, and 3,000 people got saved. I don't think it was because Peter was a great preacher.
3,000 people. I don't get that, Joel. 3,000 people just standing by, just waiting to be deconverted.
No, this is the Pentecost. You're going to have thousands upon thousands of Jews there, and 3,000 of them got saved on that day. If you read Josephus, who's not exactly Mr. Christian, Josephus very clearly
was a Jew.
Tells us that thousands of Jews were accepting Christ and becoming Christians in Jerusalem before 70 AD.
He didn't see this, though. This is what he was told. He was simply repeating what was told him. Isn't that correct?
Josephus lived from 37 to 97 AD. He was trained as a Pharisee, so he spent a good amount of time in Jerusalem. And if he's going to be trained to be a Pharisee even before the age of 23, I mean, the Jewish culture to this day, they treat 13-year-olds like adults when it comes to teaching them theology.
Mm-hmm.
So he probably went on pilgrimages to Jerusalem, and so he'd have access to pre-70 AD, first-hand access to pre-70 AD Jewish history.
And there's also some, of course, as you know, there's also some debate that there might have been quite a bit of forgery going on as well in some of Josephus' writings too, right? As it
There's been the question of the one passage that, there's two passages that mention Jesus. One is considered fully authentic, where it records the death of James, his half-brother, and so it's James, the brother of Jesus. And most Josephan scholars acknowledge, therefore, Josephus probably did write about Jesus somewhere else in that writing. Otherwise, no one would know who he was talking about as James, the brother of Jesus. And but the passage, now Gary Habermas can talk more about this than I can, but there's an alternative reading where it does seem like there may have been Christians who may have changed some of the wording and made it sound like Josephus was a believer. But there was recently, I think it was Professor Shlomo Pines found Habermas talks about this in all his works.
Right.
There's an alternative reading where Josephus doesn't sound at all like he's professing to be a believer. He's just telling us what Christians believe.
Exactly.
And he interviewed these Christians, and they said that, you know, and that he states it as fact that Jesus was crucified under Pontius Pilate, but that these Christians, they claimed that they saw him alive again 3 days after his death. They claimed he performed miracles. He was a doer of wonderful works. They claimed that he was the Messiah. They believed that he was the Messiah. And the tribe of Christians continues to this day, says Josephus.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, what that tells us, here's a guy who lived from 37 to 97 A.D., and he tells us what first-century Christianity was about. And first-century Christianity was about believing in Jesus as the Messiah who died on the cross and then rose from the dead.
Hmm.
Now you go to 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3-8, and the Apostle Paul gives an ancient creed about Jesus dying for our sins, and rising from the dead, and then appearing to the apostles on two different occasions, to Peter, he's called Cephas there, the Aramaic name, appeared to James, the half-brother of Jesus. He appeared to over 500 people at one time, and last as the one untimely born, he was appeared to the Apostle Paul. Well, with the exception of what Paul added on the end about his own experiences, this is thought to be an ancient creed. Now, Paul's writing, everybody agrees, 1 Corinthians in the mid-50s A.D. Nobody doubts that. He's writing in the mid-50s A.D., and he's saying, I pass on to you what I also received. So he's quoting some ancient tradition or ancient creed or ancient hymn.
Right.
And there are many New Testament scholars that date it back to between 33 and 37 A.D., and they believe that Paul received this tradition from Peter and James, the only two guys besides Paul who are mentioned by name, that they actually received it from them at his first meeting in Jerusalem, which would have been in the early 30s A.D. Now, I don't even think we have to argue for going back that far. All we know is that here's an ancient creed that probably predates Paul's writings. I mean, if it was just 5 or 6 years before Paul wrote Corinthians, it would predate Paul's writings. It's something he delivered to them at an earlier time. But whatever the case, or he received at an earlier time, I should say, but whatever the case, here we have this ancient creed claiming that Jesus died on the cross for our sins, rose from the dead, and appeared to many different people, including over 500 people. Paul goes out of his way to say that most of them are still alive at that point. So, we have evidence that goes back. You know, some scholars would say the 30s A.D., some would date that maybe in the 40s A.D. Whatever the case, we're getting very, very close to the event itself. And
So to
say that the Christianity that we talk about today, or the New Testament, this is legendary stuff that came years later, I mean, you have just three apostolic fathers, Clement of Rome writing 95 A.D., Ignatius writing 107 A.D., and Polycarp writing in 110 A.D., and these three guys together, they quote from or allude to 25 out of the 27 of the New Testament books. These are first century books, and Paul's writings go back to the 50s. I think we get a much closer glimpse of what early Christianity was like, original Christianity was like, from the Apostle Paul, who wrote during the 50s and 60s A.D., than we would get from the Jesus Seminar coming on the scene 2000 years
ago. Okay, well, you know, like you said, I can't wait till I get to Gary Habermas. I want you to talk more about that, because I'm curious about some more of the extra-biblical records. Because again, it just sounds like they're just saying, yeah, this is what they believed, and people who are writing about it say, yeah, we believe this too, but it doesn't really sound like there's just really no hard evidence. Maybe, I don't know, it's just not convincing to me.
Well,
but
men do not die for what they know to be a hoax. Yes, they sincerely believe they saw Jesus risen from the dead. I could explain how Muslims could be mistaken about Muhammad. It's a lot harder to, and New Testament scholars have been trying this for a couple hundred years now. It's a lot harder to explain how people could be sincerely deceived about seeing a man alive after his death on numerous occasions.
Okay. Well, anyway, thanks a lot for making an appearance. I got to run now, but I really appreciate you talking to us about Christianity. And again, we should have spent more time on it, but that's okay. Maybe next time.
And I look forward to the day where we could sit down and meet each other face-to-face and have a cup of coffee. I really, really enjoy the way you handle your show and treat your guests with respect.
Oh, well, thank you for the compliment. I really appreciate that. I don't get that very often, so. Thanks a lot. And like I said, maybe I'll have you back to talk more about that. Maybe, like I said, set up a debate maybe with maybe Bob Price or Richard Carrier or someone, or Jeff Lauder.
That would be sweet. And how is Jeff Lauder doing, by the way? Because I have not seen him in a long time.
Yeah, he's been busy with family, and I believe he's going to make a comeback, though, soon. So.
Okay, good, good.
Yeah.
Well, you tell Jeff I said hello, and I wish him the best next time you talk to him, because I really do miss him, and I long for the day when I get to see him again.
Okay, I will. Thank you very much. Have a great
night.
Thank
you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, Phil Fernandez. I'm telling you, he was being easy on me, believe it or not. He was being very easy on me. He's really good, especially at prepared debate. So, believe it or not, he was being easy on me. But I appreciate it. That way, at least we can get to the meat of the points and not try to, you know, blast each other out with just complicated jargon. So, it was pretty cool. But yeah, like I said, we got two more. We have two big-name theists going on the program, so get ready for that. Wow. It's going to be interesting. I might have to get some backup on this one. Hey, I'll see you guys another time. Thanks for listening and watching. I'll be in Stick Cam in a second. In Reason.